Episode 2 this week of the Weekside Podcast. I'm Connor Orr. Jenny Frentis is here. I am in Western New Jersey. Jenny is in the heart of, I don't know anything about New York. Are you in the heart of Manhattan?
Yeah, Upper West Side.
Okay, Jenny Frentis is in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and, you know, we're doing a football podcast, and I think that today, while we promised you a 65% Brady-free episode last week, at the beginning of last week, he does continue to make quite a bit of news. The day that we're recording this, he sat down for a lengthy chat with radio impresario Howard Stern, and I guess there was some revelatory nuggets in there about how he kind of knew since the beginning of the season that he wasn't coming back to the Patriots. But I don't know. I mean, we're going to talk about it because it's something that everybody is talking about, but I'm suffering from Brady fatigue along with a lot of other fatigues, I think, during this time. But I don't know. What was your takeaway from the big Tom Brady sit down with Howard Stern?
It was a very lengthy interview. I didn't listen to every minute of it. I listened to a few different parts of it. I did think there were some things that we don't normally hear Brady talk about. He talked about his personal life a little bit. He talked about how his friendship with Trump began. That section made me a little bit uncomfortable. I would say my main takeaway was that a lot of it made me uncomfortable. There was, I thought, some offensive language from Stern, which, okay, I know that's par for the course, but like sexist undertones. I thought some of Brady's comments were frustrating in terms of saying, you know, he didn't want to get into the political arena, but, you know, he did have a Trump hat in his locker. So he has kind of dived into the political arena a little bit. It felt like having it both ways. And the one comment that really stood out to me was when he said he doesn't see race, which I feel like is a pretty uninformed take to have in your 40s in the year 2020, right? You know, it's a pretty privileged take to have the ability to not see race, right? I mean, like, you have to be pretty privileged to say it doesn't affect me in that way, right? So felt like that was a little bit tone deaf. So I don't know, Connor. Just was some frustrating parts was my takeaway.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've never, like, I've been interested in Brady as a player. I think, you know, obviously he's one of the greatest players in NFL history, and his relationship with Belichick has been fascinating to me. But I think when you start peeling back the layers of the onion here, there's just not a whole lot there for me personally. I don't know. I mean, what were some of the questions about how he tried pot in high school? Okay, you know, or that he was hit so hard during a game that one of his organs below the belt swelled to the size of a grapefruit or something. Okay, you know, I was able to kind of pass a lot of this on without much of a second thought. I guess it was interesting to me that he said that a letter from his wife saying that she was not happy with their marriage was the reason why he started skipping OTAs, which is a difficult thing to put on one person in your house, I think. You know, but I don't know. To me, it was just, we've reached peak Brady. You know, this is like what happens to me after the penultimate episode of The Bachelor a lot. Like, we know where it's going. We know what happens. And I can barely muster the energy to listen or watch the next episode, right? It's just like, okay, I get it. He was aggrieved in New England. It was time to move on. He's happy, but he's unhappy, and whatever. He's here now, you know?
Yeah, there were some droplets of context that you referenced, right? There was a lot of speculation why he wasn't in the off-season programs, and was that a signal of the rift? And it turns out, you know, his wife had written him a letter saying he wasn't as much of a partner in the marriage as she needed. So, you know, that's a difficult thing to talk about publicly. So I thought that was interesting. But yeah, you know, I don't know. It was interesting he sat for that long of an interview. I guess everyone has a little bit of cabin fever. So maybe now was the time, Connor. But lots of other topics to talk about as well.
Yeah, I will say my final point on that is that I'm fascinated that this was, you know, he allowed this to come out in a semi-journalistic setting, right? that this was not controlled by Brady Inc. and produced in a documentary that is supposed to make him look a certain way, which we have seen. He's kind of had a very carefully cultivated image, despite the fact that he's told Howard Stern that he doesn't care about his image and his legacy. But, you know, so I guess you give him credit for that. We see very few athletes submitting to a long form sort of prodding interview in that way. So I guess you give him credit for being honest there, but you know, it's just, for me, we got a full slate, Jenny. It's April. It's in the middle of unprecedented times, but there's some football to talk about. We got some good stuff on tap.
And you know what? We had a lot of really nice messages from listeners come in that made us feel like people were actually listening to the show. I heard from someone in Australia, someone in Japan, people across the United States. I don't want to oversell the number of people that reached out, but each of them, it felt like a lot because each message was very meaningful, Connor.
Yeah, I think that's what I like the most about the whatever it is, the little community that we're building here, is that we hear from a lot of you so regularly. So, you know, thank you guys. I mean, and it really does mean a lot. I think any time that you can reach out to somebody, and you know, we're not, you know, we're okay, you know, check on your loved ones certainly, but it's just, you know, every little message goes a long way for everybody, and that includes us. You know, it's just something to say that thanks, we read them, and they're very meaningful. So
absolutely.
But all right, let's get into the news, Jenny. This is something that we foreshadowed, I think, a couple weeks ago on the Weekside podcast. But what do we have for topic number one here?
Washington head coach Ron Rivera said this week that backup Kyle Allen has a leg up on rookie Dwayne Haskins as they head into an inevitably shortened camp. A few weeks back, we talked about the fishiness or scrawdiness. Nice, Connor. Nice. Of this situation. And with rumors that Washington may still be interested in a quarterback at number two, what does the future hold for the 2019 first rounder out of Ohio State? Connor, I want to credit you. You have been on top of this, saying that you don't quite buy that things are, you know, moving ahead with Haskins.
I think that this is either one of three things. One is that Ron Rivera signed Kyle Allen and he's going to start Kyle Allen, and he's known that all along. Two is that he's challenging Dwayne Haskins. He's trying to get him motivated, and this is the way that he's doing it. Or three, that they are either wanting teams to trade up to them at number two or are very much considering taking a quarterback at number two. And Rivera is setting the stage for that as well. I'm not sure how that order works exactly, but I do think that there's something here. I mean, something kind of smells a little bit.
Yeah, I thought there were two takeaways from Rivera's comment. One is it added a little bit of context to the fact that they didn't sign Cam Newton. Part of the reason he said they signed Allen was it was someone that if they had 2 weeks to go, they could put him in and play. And, you know, he obviously knows the playbook. The offensive coordinator is Scott Turner. So he came to Washington from Carolina. So there's clearly a familiarity there with the system. So with Cam Newton, if you had signed him, you wouldn't have that option for sure. He's still coming back from season-ending foot surgery. You do not know that he would necessarily be ready to pop in if you had a very short preparation period. So that made a little bit more sense. But yeah, the second thing is it just didn't sound like somebody that was very convinced with Haskins. You know, Rivera was a first-time head coach in Carolina in 2011 during the lockout, and he said what they did was once they knew Cam was going to be the guy, which he was the number one overall pick, they made sure that he just got extra reps, that everything was skewed so that he got the most preparation and the most potential practice to ready him for starting day one. So the fact that his response with Haskins is not that, but rather, hey, and I look back at what the exchange was. After he said some of these things about Allen, someone followed up and said, so you would probably start Kyle Allen if it came into a situation like that, which was referencing the shortened camp. And Rivera replied, if that was a situation, Kyle would have a leg up on the situation, most certainly. So it seems like they're preparing to start Allen. And I agree that opens the door that would they take a quarterback, you know, because if he's not sold on Haskins, probably doesn't think Allen's a long-term answer. He just thinks he would be more available for the team to go week one.
It's so fascinating, the tightrope that these coaches walk. And I thought that more teams would take a better page out of the Cardinals' book last year when they just completely torpedoed Josh Rosen's value over the course of a few weeks heading into the draft. If Washington is interested in taking a quarterback, I don't think that they're doing a good job of bolstering Haskins's value at all either. I mean, this could be one of those things where, again, you're left with pennies on the dollar. And not saying that I don't know what a return on Haskins would look like anyway, right? I mean, he slipped in a draft where, I don't know. I think that there was certainly room for him to be one of the top two or three quarterbacks if he was a more enticing prospect. But I don't know. I don't necessarily think that that's what they're going to do, but it seems like at the least Rivera has not been sold on Haskins. He's talked more about his work ethic and what he sees anecdotally, but not like, hey, you know how some coaches will say immediately, you know, I saw the film on this guy and it blew me away. I mean, that's one of those things that you can say in a position of a new head coach. Ron Rivera hasn't said anything like that.
The question of Haskins' value is also an interesting one because this has been such an oversaturated quarterback market. And there are still people out there lingering, right? Newton among them. And obviously he's got the injury situation. But this isn't a year where you probably could get a big return if you wanted to trade a former first round drafted quarterback that you don't plan to start. So the value would probably be even lower than it was for Rosen just because there are fewer teams with a need.
Yeah. And it's crazy. I mean, you know, everyone says all the time that, you know, we can invest in these guys, we can build a scheme around these guys. To me, it's still unbelievable that this is happening in this like date and time in NFL history. But here we are again, where, I mean, God, imagine the worst case scenario there where Haskins goes to, I don't know, John Gruden will probably want him. He loves first round quarterbacks, to the Raiders for a fifth round pick or something like that. You know, I mean, these situations that seem unfathomable a year ago, and everybody talks everybody up and how we're going to do this and do that. And it's just lip service. And then these poor players end up having their career just completely throttled.
Yeah, yeah. But that really, this adds a lot of intrigue, you know, to the top of the draft. It adds a lot of intrigue because we don't know what Rivera is going to do at number two. We don't know what the Lions are going to do at number three. We know the Giants aren't going to take a quarterback at four, but will they trade down? So it does get a little bit interesting. We talked on the show earlier this week, Connor, we went through your mock draft, and could it be a boring top five? It totally could, but it could also be kind of spicy.
I think we're headed towards Spice City, which is interesting in that, you know, like we're going to talk about a little bit later on the show. this is all online. This is like you and I trying to write, I don't know, a deadline story together over Google Zoom or something like that. I don't know have we ever had a co-byline story together in all of our years of working together?
I don't know. I have done two recent co-bylines with Greg Bishop, who lives in Seattle, and one of them was the Super Bowl game story, so we were sitting together at a table, but the other one we wrote about the Raiders last year, and we were not in geographical proximity. So we actually had a Google Doc, and we sat on, like, we each wrote sections, but then we got on the phone together, and we went through paragraph by paragraph and, like, talked about things and moved things around. So I don't know. It opened my eyes about a different way of doing work, which I think we're all seeing in this weird time, right? I mean, Connor, we had a MMQB-ish happy hour last week at the Tartinery, which was a bar that we used to go to with some of our former coworkers, and that felt really fun to me. Like, it felt like we were together, and I never would have thought that.
I loved it, and so I think that, hey, maybe anything is possible. Maybe you can have a draft and trades and a bunch of early first-round spice while Goodell is sitting in his home office and... where is he in Nyack?
Bronxville, I think. Bronxville.
Bronx.
Yeah,
in Bronxville.
Up in Westchester. You know what, yeah. I was thinking along while we're on this topic, and then we'll move on to topic number two. But okay, if you had a technical issue, because this has come up a lot, like, will they allow teams that have a technological gaffe, you know, if you were in a desperate situation and there was some kind of Zoom issue and you knew the player you were going to pick, would you just text Goodell?
That's
amazing.
I'm actually
being serious. Like, as a, like, he's got to announce it, right? I mean, I don't know. Maybe you're going out of the order of operations or out of whatever the protocol would be. But like, if things got really dire and you're the Miami Dolphins and the clock's about to expire and you need to get Tua's name, and you just text Tua to get out.
Could you imagine like whatever it would be, Chris Greer, like, and you're Goodell and you just get like a, what's the Miami area code? What's a good Miami area code?
Well, like, Miami's 305, but they're up in Davie. So I feel like they're usually like in the 954 range.
He just gets a text from like a random 954 number that isn't in his phone, and it just says Tua.
Tua.
I would love that. You know what else I was just thinking about too? You're Goodell, right? And you're doing this from home. I think Mike Florio mentioned this, which I thought was a good point. The optics would be much better if you're doing it from home, right? You want to make it seem like I'm taking this seriously as the commissioner of the NFL, and I'm at my house, so you should be at your house. So hopefully he does do it at home. What do you do? This is a big bookcase behind you situation, right? I mean, you're really going to have to curate this in the coming weeks, because that video of him is going to be paused. It's going to be enhanced. It's going to be picked apart, because everybody likes to make fun of the commissioner and get a little peek into his home life that we've never had before. So if you're Roger, this is a big week for your little bookshelf in your office. It's probably not a little bookshelf. It's probably a big office.
Yeah, this is where I think they do the Zoom that makes it look like the stage would have looked, because I don't think Goodell's going to want people zooming in on his bookshelf. Because what if there's like a book about one team over another? You know, Patriots fans are going to say, well, there's like 18 teams represented in the backdrop, but of course we're not there. Like, you can see all the conspiracy theories brewing. Or there's like another no call and the Saints are like, well, he didn't have a fleur-de-lis, so of course he wasn't giving us any help.
One of my favorite things is, like, when this whole like phenomenon started, the, you know, doing video with everything, we were both at the Star Ledger and NJ.com, and they started doing that big video push. And I remember the first few times that I had done a Skype interview or something like that, I was living in, you can't even call it an apartment, because I don't think it was technically a legal apartment. It was more like an extended closet. And it just had like a ridge against the wall where my bed was. And so I didn't have any room for books or anything like that. And so I just put one book behind me on the to kind of poke fun at the idea of having a robust bookshelf. But, and it was always Jerry Eisenberg's No Medals for Trying.
Wow.
That was my, an autographed copy, by the way, legendary columnist Jerry Eisenberg's 1989 book about the New York Giants, where he spent like 2 or 3 weeks traveling with the team or whatever. So that was like my one book on the bookshelf.
That's a great pull, though.
It is a great pull. And Jerry autographed it when I asked him to sign it. Dear Connor, a friend in need is a pain in the ass. Love, Jerry.
That sounds spot on. Jerry, of course, went to every Super Bowl until this year. This was the first one that his streak ended. So pretty remarkable run.
Definitely. Thinking about you, Jerry.
He's probably not listening. But in case he is, you're on our minds.
That's right. All right. What do we got for number two? This is an exciting one. I'm ready to go for this. Two teams, the Buccaneers and the Falcons, revealed new uniforms this week to mixed fanfare. Given both of our extensive experiences in the world of high fashion, what do we think are the pros and cons of each look?
Connor, you nailed it. The Buccaneers whiffed on bringing back the creamsicle.
Totally. Like, totally. And I think that in order to make this Brady thing work to the fullest extent, you know, we've heard comparisons to Miami pulling down LeBron James and turning the games into an event in this star-studded thing. You had to go full Tampa. You had to ooze Tampa, and you had to be appropriately ridiculous with your uniform choice. And I feel like they just didn't do it. They went back to the Gruden era, the 97 to 2014 look, and then just kind of changed a few stripes and, like, you know, darkened a few colors and stuff like that. Just a very safe choice. It's clean. It's fine. Serviceable. But I don't know. I thought that this was the time to go full creamsicle.
I totally agreed with your take, Connor, which readers can find on the MMQB website. I was expecting a creamsicle. I did like the pewter. I am a big pewter gunmetal type color fan. My car, I have a Toyota RAV4 from 2007, and it was flint mica, which is exactly that pewter color. So I do like that they leaned into the pewter a little bit more, but the white was, to me, indistinguishable from the Falcon's white. Now the Falcons released a redesign the next day, but yeah, it was just, you couldn't tell much of a difference. There wasn't like, it wasn't this big, oh my gosh, this is really dramatic and we're really excited about it.
I have not seen a uniform reveal that blew me away positively or negatively in a long time. I mean, the Buccaneers' last uniform reveal, I think, was like, oh my God, this is so bad that, you know, I can't stop thinking about it. But other than that, I mean, everybody's been so safe, and it seems like everything is coming to this unsatisfying middle ground where it's just, you know, it seems like it's all designed by the same, like, two or three people that have the same two or three ideas, you know?
Yeah, that's so true about the middle ground. I remember feeling that way about the Giants and Jets stadium because they were trying to have the stadium that could be either blue for the Giants or green for the Jets. And so they basically produced a gray stadium that they could add some lights to. And I just remember thinking, like, wow, this is really boring. And if you go to the two teams' practice facilities, they each had different styles. You know, the Giants facility is brick, the traditional look, and the Jets kind of went with this new age thing with these, you know, long white hallways with big photos and neon green signs and things like that. And it was at least referencing or drawing in the team's personality a little bit, whereas MetLife Stadium was just kind of a big gray bowl. So
yeah, I think someone once told me from an architectural standpoint, one of the biggest missed opportunities in like recent big time architecture history, right? You have the most beautiful and iconic skyline in the world in your backyard, and you build like a big cheese grater around it, you know, so that nobody can see it. I don't know. That was bad. But what do you think about the Falcons? To me, the Falcons' new uniforms are like almost indistinguishable from like the Jets. It's like this, like it's like taking what was already a thing and then just making it like a more general version, like almost like they don't have the rights to their own logo, and so they have to put the Falcons in a movie, and this is the uniform that they choose. The only interesting thing there is, I guess, there is the gradient where the red kind of like sparkles into the black at the bottom of the uniform, which I don't know. That's not really for me. That's sort of an Ed Hardy vibe for me.
I thought the gradient was horrible, Connor. Not a fan of that. I agree with you. It's kind of the Jets comparison to me is a very good one because it's kind of making it more arena football-y, but really not doing anything that's notable. I think our friend Jonathan Jones tweeted this, and I agree with it. I didn't mind the ATL, but not on every iteration, or three out of four iterations, I think it was. Like, that's maybe something that you could have on one of the versions, but it was on too many of the versions.
Yeah, and again, I mean, this is the third time we're talking about this in 4 weeks with the Rams, with the Buccaneers, and with the Falcons. You had so many good options in your past. Like, the Falcons uniforms in the 70s, the red ones with the red helmet and the black bird, and then the 90s when they made the Super Bowl, the Dirty Bird years, those were great uniforms, and people would go nuts if you went back to that. And I don't understand why teams just aren't realizing that you can just touch up the old uniforms that people remember from their past, and it's going to be so much better, I think, than trying to design these bland new, like, whatever it is, you know. I don't even know what to call this trend, but it's like, I don't know, it's like the HGTVification of uniforms, you know.
Yeah, it's like when everyone paints their house repose gray or
shiplap.
Yeah, the shiplap. I mean, just all the same recycled color concepts.
Do you know, by the way, stop me if you're the one who told me this, because this seems like an interesting fact that you would know, why every single house on any HGTV remodeling show features an open concept?
I don't know the answer, Connor.
So they've basically started a revolution. Like, now, any anybody that walks into a house, a naive home buyer that, you know, is influenced by HGTV wants an open concept because that's what's on TV and that's what all their friends have and that's what is popular, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But the reason that they started doing it is because their demographics skewed female and that they found that if they featured more demolition in a show, that they got a higher percentage of a male audience. And the way that you do that, more demolition, is by knocking down walls. And what you get by knocking down walls in a cost-effective and speedy way is an open concept. And so they started pressuring people, I guess, apparently, to knock down more walls and to get more people to watch the show. And thus, now everything has to be an open concept.
Connor, that might be the most interesting piece of information you've ever shared on the show.
What does that say about me?
No, that says about the quality of this information.
Yeah, I don't know where I heard that from. Now, I'm going to get like a peppering of tweets now, and that could be like one of those things where you're just like, uh-oh, I don't know. I might have just read that in a magazine or something like that. But I feel like somebody told me that. Like, that's a true thing.
That's pretty interesting. Well, I'm looking around my box of an apartment because I live in New York, right? And I'm like, well, I guess it could be sold as an open concept because the foyer, the kitchen, dining room, living room, closet, hallway to the bathroom are just really all together here. The only thing that's not is the galley kitchen, which is kind of shoved onto the side of the apartment. But really, all the rooms flow together because I live in a box.
Hey, that's an open concept, you know? What is the other funny, I love like the real estate words, not to describe your apartment in particular, but like if a house isn't small, it's charming, right? Or
it's not old, it's charming, right? Or it's not old, it's like, what's the word?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not old, it's charming, it's not small, it's quaint.
Yes.
It's not dilapidated, it's rustic. Right.
Fixer-upper. Yeah.
A little fixer-upper, but that's good. All right. What do we have for number three?
Remote drafting is now officially a thing. Amid the furious push by the NFL to stage their tentpole event virtually, a ton of concerns have surfaced regarding how the operations will run, and especially when it comes to undrafted free agents, which teams will play by the rules.
None.
Yeah, this would be my guess. Gonna be because the rules they're making them up as they go. So there's certainly going to be loopholes, things that aren't hammered out. Maybe teams will claim they didn't fully understand the rules. This is just gonna be the I feel like this phrase is used way too often in the NFL, but it's going to be the wild, wild west of the NFL draft.
I liked I read somewhere that Kevin Colbert had suggested giving them three extra rounds next year as like a payment or whatever, or as like an apology for the craziness this year. But I think it's interesting that, you know, we all know, and we've talked to agents and we've talked to undrafted free agents about this time and time again, the chaotic atmosphere that surrounds the undrafted free agent process. You know, that's a thing that we've known for a long time, but now it kind of opens it up to an even more significant level. And once a year, there is one or two bangers that are found in this pool, this talent pool. Like, it's not like I think we could go back every season for the last whatever since we've been covering football and pegged one really great undrafted free agent that helped change the fortunes of their team.
Yeah, there's a lot of unknown in this draft about how it's going to go. I've heard some coaches say things like, well, it's just going to force you to get back to the fundamentals and rely on the tape more. But I don't even know if they really know what that means. I guess you don't have all these extra points of contact, but I'm not sure if anyone has a sense of like, well, we're going to lean on the tape more, if that's good or bad. I do think it'll be a safer draft. I think there will be less gambles. And again, I don't know if that ends up being good or bad, because sometimes if there's a player that has some kind of issue, whether it be medical or maybe there's some kind of character concern, you can really get a handle on that with in-person contact, and maybe it's actually okay. Whereas now, I think those players will be potentially pushed down a little bit more. And maybe, you know, I don't know if that ends up being good or bad. Like, all of these things are, it's just going to be what it is. And I guess people are counting on the fact that everyone's operating under the same circumstances, but I'm sure we'll look back and 6 months or so, or maybe in a couple of years when we see how this draft class truly panned out, and people will say, well, this was the advantage that Bill Belichick called from doing X, Y, and Z in the draft.
It makes me think back to something that Ernie Accorsi told me a few years ago, the old Giants GM, which is that he's like, we used to draft these guys out of magazines. He's like, let's be realistic about it. We would pick up the whatever Street and Smith College Football Report, and we would read it on the train ride in to wherever we were going. And, you know, we would pick these guys out of a catalog. We didn't know anything. Sometimes we would pick up the phone and call the coach and you would talk to him. But other times you had no idea what was going on. Al Davis would draft the fastest guy in the draft, and there were schools like Villanova who would look for attention, and they would move up the start of the 40-yard dash to the 36-yard line, and all of a sudden these slow white guys would be getting drafted in the first round by the Raiders. And like, there was absolute chaos back then, and everything still worked out. So I think it's going to be fine. It's just, you know, a matter of which teams are going to find that, like you said, that little leg up and make something of it, and which of these teams are going to kind of sit and stew and really make this a big issue. Because I do think that there is a big still contingent of people who are very upset about this and want to Goodell to make sure that they're heard.
I think that's true. I think there's a lot of people who are annoyed that this is going forward. And I think some of those people are inflexible and not willing to do things a different way. But I do think a good portion of those people are really bothered by the fact that we're focusing on this when there are a lot of other things going on and everyone is kind of operating below capacity and anything else but the essentials. Like, I think it's a mix.
I do. Yeah, definitely. All right. What do we have here for... So number four is interesting. Major League Baseball floated what I would guess is kind of a trial balloon idea of a season start next month in a central location in Arizona without fans. That includes rigorous texting while they figure it out. Yeah, rigorous testing, and essentially, if you test positive, you're admitted to the or test negative, you're admitted to the bubble, and in the bubble, you go straight from your hotel to your game, and then you come back home, and you know, you kind of do a few months of the season that way. It's been some pretty fierce opposition from the players, which I don't blame them for. I mean, we read about Mike Trout, who would ostensibly miss the birth of and the first few months of his child's life if he decided to do something like that, and I would not do that, you know, obviously not. But this just seems crazy to me, and I hope that this isn't one of those things where the NFL's got their ear to the ground and they're thinking, oh, yeah, maybe we could do something like this.
I agree. I also joined the chorus of people who thought this was a little bit suspicious that it came out after the commissioners of the major sports leagues had a phone call with the president. So then you kind of wondered what pressure was being put on leagues to kind of push things forward. Of course, we've seen a lot of pressure with that. You know, people will be back at church by Easter, which of course now is... The thought of that is clearly absurd, although it probably was absurd initially when it was said. So this idea, another reporter texted me, Connor, like, are we going to have to go all be together somewhere in Montana, like covering this? And I think like just the thought of that is crazy. Like even for us as reporters, right? Think about, and that translates to athletes because everyone has some semblance of the same things going on in their lives, right? I mean, you'd be away from your family. You would not be there to help get through if you're a parent, you know, homeschooling or making sure that your kid is cared for. You would be far away if there was any kind of issue with your elderly relatives. And I just, the amount of resources that would be required to make this go and the number of people that would be stripped away from their societal responsibilities just to make sure a sports league goes forward is pretty stunning to me, Connor.
Yeah, I mean, I would protest to the highest regard. You'd probably have to, like, box me up and ship me there somehow without me knowing about it to get me to do something like that. It's just like, we need to realize that, like, yes, everybody needs distractions and these big sports leagues need advertisers and revenue and everything like that. But like, how disastrous would it be to just, you know, it's not like baseball's going anywhere or football's going anywhere or basketball's going anywhere. You take a big hit for a year and then you move on. You know, you jack up your prices a little bit once everybody's healthy and we're free of this pandemic, and you make up for it somehow over the course of 3 or 4 or 5 years. But this stuff is dystopian. You know, it's just crazy to me that there's a bubble and we're going to let these players just go back and forth. I mean, you know, they've already been quarantined for months and then we're going to force them to do this. And even the mental health implications of this are out of control. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I really hope that was just a bad, stupid idea, you know?
And the idea that it could truly be a closed environment, I think, is also inaccurate, because you're still having deliveries coming and going. If somebody gets, you know, has an issue where they have to leave, then they replace that person with someone else. The reality is, even if you had a rapid test, first of all, you'd have to administer that test pretty frequently. And second of all, nothing takes the place of a vaccine. Once we get to the point of a vaccine, then it's a different conversation, because people can be vaccinated and you can move forward. But from what medical professionals have said, it's that takes a while. You'd have to develop it and go through human trials. And so I think they're always going to, until there's a vaccine that's in place and everything can truly resume as normal, there's always going to be this trying to figure out ways around it to engineer these safe environments. And it's just a strange fixation and use of resources.
I agree. One note, by the way, on an earlier point that we made about the uniforms, I just thought it was great that the Carolina Panthers tweeted the Falcons uniform reveal and then compared it to the uniform that the Prisoners wore in The Longest Yard, the Adam Sandler movie. And then the Falcons replied to that with the hashtag shine through the shade, but they did it in all Cam Newton letters, like
Whoa.
Which I really thought was just, I mean, chef's kiss, wonderful Twitter today. So
NFC South really mixes it up back and forth on Twitter. I feel like there's been a few Twitter feuds among the NFC South teams.
It's solid. It's really solid. And you know what? I felt like we just needed a little, what do you call like the sherbet course in between meals?
Palate cleanser.
A little palate cleanser after that, because just even talking about forcing these guys into a bubble just makes my blood boil.
Maybe a creamsicle flavored palate cleanser.
Ah, very good. I like that. All right, so the fifth topic, we're in the throes of draft rumor season, which is actually getting pretty good. I will say it's starting to get a little crazy. Mm-hmm. We've seen everything from a potential, hey, maybe the Bengals don't really like Joe Burrow and maybe the Dolphins can come up and get him because they got a bunch of first round picks, and maybe the Lions are actually going to take a quarterback at number 3. Maybe Washington, like we talked about, is going to take quarterback at number 2. I think we're all assuming that Joe Burrow is going number 1. I think that is as safe of an assumption as we can have at this moment. But beyond that, we don't really know. And I think, you know, we had my mock draft that we talked about earlier in the week, but I'm curious, and we're going to get to yours, on the show early next week, when it's revealed, but who is the second quarterback being taken? And do we think we're in agreement on that at this point?
Yeah, you're right. There has been a lot of stuff flying around, and I was on a call with Daniel Jeremiah, the NFL Network draft analyst and former scout, and he was talking about what would be the possibility if the Dolphins were so sure on Burrow and would offer something to the Bengals. And he thought the Dolphins might have to move up first to 3 and then to 1, because the Dolphins or the Bengals wouldn't want to go that far down to 5. So it might have to be a 2-part trade. And then I started thinking about like, how are these things happening? And there's already teams concerned about the ability to do trades on draft night. Ron Rivera the other day was saying that they're going to have to institute a cutoff time, where what's our cutoff in the first round? Is it 4 minutes, 2 minutes? If we have nothing cooking early in the clock, should we just move on? So I do wonder if that is a tangible impact, that they're would be less maneuvering on draft night. But yes, I think the consensus is that Burrow will go number 1. And I feel pretty assured that he would go to the Bengals, even if the Dolphins offered you a lot, and they clearly can because they have this chest of draft picks. would it be worth passing up on a guy like Burrow? And I think the way that the Bengals are, I think that they're an organization that would be inclined to stand pat there. So let's say Burrow does go one. I would not rule out Herbert being the second quarterback taken, Connor.
I agree. He was the second quarterback taken in my mock draft. It's funny. I mean, as soon as that came out, there was the, I forget who did a post on it, just like, I can't believe all these people are now falling for the Herbert smokescreen. But this was pre-smokescreen Herbert. Like some of the teams, I think, just prefer him to Tua. And I think that that was the case even before we entered this period of the draft where now every rumor is like bouncing left and right and circulating like crazy.
Yeah. Right. There's obviously with Tua the questions about, are you comfortable enough without being able to pull on his hip essentially a second time, right? They, you know, he was examined at the combine, but there was supposed to be a recheck, and he's coming out with these videos, and I'm sure more of them will come out. But it does sound like there is a concern there, but that most teams would be okay and say it's worth it. But yeah, I think you'll find people who think that Tua and Burrow are ahead of the rest of the class. And I think you'll also find people or teams where they're split on Tua and Herbert. So I think it's totally possible that Herbert goes before Tua.
I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, I don't know. There's so many ridiculous reasons why having this draft where it is can affect everybody's livelihood and all this stuff. I mean, we shouldn't be guessing. You know, teams should have a crystal clear medical picture of Tua right now, you know, or as crystal clear as possible. And it's just, it's crazy that this is what we're talking about and that kind of this is where we are. But, you know, hey, there's going to be a, some team is probably going to get a nice player that they might just have to wait a little bit to play, you know, and a little bit later on in the draft, which I think is going to be interesting.
Yeah, absolutely, Connor. All right, I think we're on to our favorite part of the show.
Ooh, the Oracle. So I'm not, I was interested, I've been following a lot of the press conferences, obviously. A lot of the coaches have been doing Zoom meetings with their beat reporters, which I think is good. And I've been interested, and I don't know if this is a prediction, but it's just an interesting sort of thing to hear Matt Rhule sort of talk about. You know, how he's handled going from, you know, I can't wait to work with Cam Newton to, yeah, we had to let him go to, you know, his, what he said about Eric Reed, I thought was pretty interesting that, oh, well, you know, I wasn't really here doing the evaluations on players. So that's not like, you know, 100% my decision. And, you know, Reed is obviously a player that, you know, you would wonder is he being cut because he's not good enough or he doesn't fit your defense, or is he being cut because he's an outspoken player who is passionate about, you know, racial inequality and social justice. And I don't know, it's just been interesting to see his early tenure there. I think if he was in a bigger market, I think he'd struggle a little bit because these are questions that demand, I think, more complicated answers than they're getting.
Okay. That's interesting, Connor. Yeah. I think there are a lot of questions with the direction that things are going in Carolina. And yeah. All right. I like that one.
Give us a Ventus consensus, something to end the show on harmoniously.
Well, we've seen through this pandemic that some players continue to work out together. We saw Lamar Jackson about a week ago with Marquise Brown and Antonio Brown, which raises some questions in and of itself. This week, we saw Dak Prescott and Dez Bryant throwing. And, you know, I think I'm not exactly sure what the league can do, but I do think there should be some kind of rules or restrictions that prohibit this so players don't think they can continue to do it on the sly and get some kind of advantage that way. Obviously, these things are against public health codes, and I'm not sure why. It just kind of reinforces this concern that we've had all along with the NFL moving forward with business as usual, that they think they're kind of exempt from it or above it. And I think star players continuing to work out together is not a good thing.
Yeah, and it's like the constant, you know, in the NFL, you have to pose for a picture every time you exercise with your friend and, you know, and put it on Instagram. But, like, could we at least do without that, you know? And, like, they're all clustered together and hugging and, like, clearly in violation of the social distance norms. But kids see that, you know? I mean, high school football players who are getting ready for a season or a camp or a 7-on-7 thing, I mean, this is a visible thing for them. And they're like, well, if the guys that I look up to are doing this, then, you know, I need to be out on the field and I need to be working out and I need to be, you know, getting receivers together. Or you just... you got to work out from home. You know, look at Kyler Murray. I think he was playing catch with somebody from the recliner to the bedroom the other day. You know, I think that's, you know, that's kind of your options at this point.
Yeah, and I think there's this whole no days off culture, not just in sports, but in the U.S. And I think we're seeing this with some people who are essential workers, where they feel like they would be weak if they did not go into work. I saw something where there was a doctor who had some symptoms and decided to stay home and then felt panicked that her tests would come back negative because her coworkers would think that she was just home for a headache. And it was almost a relief because it wasn't super serious, although then her symptoms did worsen over time. So you see people in essential roles who are kind of having these, oh my gosh, should I not? And then I think when you have athletes who really are not essential at this point in time or at any point in time, and they're continuing to work out, I think it just sends a bad message.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. I hope, hope we all just get a little bit smarter. I mean, you know, we're starting to hear like the, you know, in New York and New Jersey and our area, just these like, I mean, obviously the numbers are horrific and awful and there's no proper way to pivot from that, but that we are seeing encouraging signs that maybe some of the stuff that we're doing is working. And it's like, why isn't everybody else kind of just hopping on this momentum? You know, I mean, we can all get back together and do normal things if we just follow the rules, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks everyone for joining. Thanks to all of our listeners, whether you're in Japan, Australia, the US, wherever you are, we appreciate you tuning in now twice a week. And we will be back next week. And we also will be back, I believe, on the MMQB Roundtable, the weekend review this Friday. So you can find
us there
as well. Can't get rid of us. We're just really too many places, but we appreciate the support. The MMQB Weekside Podcast is me, Jenny Vrentis, and Connor Orr. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Moravik is emeritus executive director of the MMQB. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.